Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm host Anthony. This week, entertainment reporter Kim Renfro from Insider is here to talk about Sansa's final chapter in this first book. Kim, of course, is the author of The Unofficial Guide to Game of Thrones, which you can buy anywhere that you buy books. If you'd like to complete your journey with Steve and I, as we move through his first viewing of the show, we are over at Double Dragon. We've dropped a couple episodes over at Double Dragon, so meet us over there. Do a search for Double Dragon wherever you search for podcasts. I also have more of my conversation with Kim Renfro over there about House of the Dragon. Okay, without further ado, here is Insider entertainment reporter Kim Renfro. Kim, I kind of feel like this chapter, you know, we've seen some really horrific stuff in this book, but this chapter's one of the darkest chapters, I think, in the entire book.
Yeah. It really, rereading this, I was like, oh, in our first two pages, I want to say, Sansa is like experiencing suicidal ideations and gets absolutely molested by Maester Pycelle.
Holy moly, I did not remember that. And I almost thought, am I reading this right? Because, you know, I guess he's supposed to be a doctor, but why does he have to touch her everywhere?
And the detail that she was being held down.
Yes.
By, like, the vision of this child being, like, held down naked in her bed and, like, examined against her will when she's, like, in the deepest grief of her life. And
it's just, yes, it's just a nightmare. Yeah. It's a nightmare. I mean, I guess she does have literal nightmares as well. But, yeah, you have her in basically locked in this room, knowing that her life is never going to be the same again, and really kind of being forced to become a political player.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, she kind of was a political player before this, but in a way that she knows she's working without a net now.
Yeah, or that she, like, there was a level of naivety to the way that she was approaching being in court, because that's how she was taught, you know, all of the things that she was taught about being a young woman and a potential future queen. She thought she was doing all the right things. She thought that, like, she could trust Cersei and that Joffrey really had, like, true loving feelings for her, or, like, affectionate feelings for her. And it's like, okay, the blindfold has been fully ripped off and her father was executed in front of her all in one blow. And it's really, it's just really tragic to be inside her head for seeing this.
Yeah. She is, you're right, she kind of, this chapter more than any other chapter is a move away from sort of the naivete of childhood and almost toward a political cynicism. She's like remembering all the different things that she's learned, you know, from the Hound, from Peter Baelish. You know, she's thinking through these things that people have mentioned to her over time, and she's realizing this is nothing like the stories I've been reading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the real world, monsters win
mm-hmm.
and the heroes lose. So yeah, it really sort of is this decided move toward political cynicism, it seems to me.
Yeah, and to me reading it, it's really misogyny laid bare. Right? Like when Meryn Trant first beats her on behalf of Joffrey, she has this realization. I wrote down this quote where she says, "He did not hate her, Sansa realized, nor did he love her. He felt nothing for her at all. She was only a thing to him."
Mm-hmm.
And this idea where she's seeing extraordinarily brutally for the first time the way that these men and even Cersei don't view her as a person with feelings mm-hmm. or a person worthy of any type of like empathy. She's literally just a tool to them to do whatever they wish with her body. And
yeah,
it's like seeing her realizing that, is just so awful. And then you also kind of hear another one that I wrote down, is when Joffrey's talking to her about Cersei and says like Cersei had been crying because Jaime was captured, and Joffrey says women are all weak, even her, his mother.
Even her.
And I'm
It's
like, yeah,
funny
Cersei taught
because,
him this.
yeah, it's funny because he's so in her pocket at times. Like he'll say, "Mother says I have to do this. Mother says, you have to do this." So he's appealing to her as kind of this authority. I think he knows that he's not as politically savvy as his mother, but he's also kind of been taught this hyper-aggressive masculinity, and I think he's trying to perform it in a way that kind of proves that he's the king. And clearly, I mean, he's sort of doing the opposite. He's being anything but chivalrous here, I think. And she also kind of sees him for what he is for the first time. I think she's been kind of trying to deceive herself about what he really his true nature. But now he's just like this cruel man with worm lips. he's got these soft red worm lips.
And I like, and there's something like, especially, I don't know, the fact that he has his grown men soldiers beat her on his behalf is like, he can't, she sees that he can't even do it himself, or that like, yeah, he's just the worst. And like, and yeah, her seeing that, and also her seeing that, in a way, her and Cersei are like kind of in the same boat, but for entirely different reasons. Like, Cersei is part of the reason why Joffrey is the way that he is. And like, the fact that he doesn't respect her is almost like partially her fault, because she's taught him to think about women this way. She just, Cersei maybe assumed that she would be the exception to the rule, but that's not how this works. And so like, Cersei eventually realizes that she's a little bit out of her depths with the way that Joffrey is
Right, of
behaving. And
course.
Sansa, of course, didn't sign up for this at all, but she was drawn into it by Cersei.
Well, and also, I think that Robert is to blame to a certain extent here, because why does Cersei tell Joffrey that a king shouldn't beat his wife? It's because Robert
Did the same
was
thing
an
to
abusive
her.
husband to her. So when he would hit Cersei, I think Cersei's thinking, my son's never going to hit his wife. But it's almost making it worse to have these grown men do it. Oh, it's just such a rotten system from, everyone involved has sort of conspired to make Sansa's life totally miserable.
And then you get like the weird, like the Hound is so interesting, because like he's doing the bare minimum to help her, right? Like, he's not actually protecting her, because I don't know, he feels like he
Oh, I think
can't.
I read, I think I read him a little bit differently. I was thinking he's doing the bare minimum to do Joffrey's bidding. I think he knows, like, we all have to play this part here, and you're gonna have to play yours, and that includes getting beaten from time to time. But I do think that he's actually trying to help her, because I don't think he loves Joffrey at all. So I think he knows he's being used by the system. He knows he's sort of a tool of Joffrey's cruelty. But I think he's trying to do something for Sansa here that she doesn't quite understand.
Yeah, he's certainly trying to protect her in, I guess, what he believes is like the safest way of like, can't be too obvious about it, because then Joffrey's just going to punish us both. But at the same time, it's like, I view that as like, as the barest minimum effort of like, I don't know.
It's
He's
interesting.
resigned to play that part.
Right.
In the castle.
If he was a true knight, he would whisk her away and bring her to safety. But he's kind of trying to say, okay, we're stuck here. This kid is cruel. You have to learn to endure this cruelty, and I can teach you how.
Yeah. Which is really sad.
It's totally
sad for
cynical.
Him, and it's sad for her that, like, seems to be the only option. So, yeah.
All right, I'm going to read my synopsis here.
Okay.
And all right, so Sansa's locked in her room, weeping, dreaming, and refusing food. She dreams of her father and his beheading. In her nightmares, Sir Ilyn Payne is stalking her with her father's sword, ready to strike. This lasts for days, and as attested by the uneaten food that is piling up and spoiling, she is not eating. Pycelle visits her and gets totally creepy. Then Joffrey visits. She's taken from her bed by the Hound and told that she will address Joffrey as Your Grace. And then she's beaten by Meereen Trant for insulting the boy king. She's instructed to attend court later that day. After bathing and covering her bruised face with makeup, she goes to court. Joffrey vacillates between disinterest and cruelty in the cases brought before him. When the day's justice has been settled, Joffrey takes her outside to show her her father's head. He shows her Septa Mordain's head too and threatens to mount Robb's head too. Sansa suggests that Robb might win and take Joffrey's head. She's beaten again by Trant and thinks about throwing Joffrey from the parapet, but doesn't. After all, she is a woman of courtesy. So, Kim Renfro, what shall we talk about? You want to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
I think I want to climb the ladder of chaos.
All right, you go first.
Okay. Well, one thing I just wanted to point out about this chapter that I love is the foreshadowing with Janos Slynt. Mm-hmm. Do you know about this?
Foreshadowing in what way?
So when Sansa is observing Joffrey in court, she trains her gaze for a certain time on Janos Slynt, who's like sitting there and looking very smug in his like cozy position. And she remembers that he was the one who like grabbed Ned and put him on his knees so that he could be executed. And she says that she wishes that someone would just throw down Janos Slynt and take off his head.
And that's what John does.
That's what John does 4 books later. And without, I'm pretty sure without knowing that Janos Slynt had that role in Ned Stark's death. Like Janos Slynt has just done so many other awful things up until that point that he's deserving of this execution at John's hands. And I just, because John and Sansa have such an unexplored relationship in the books, really, like they, in the books, we haven't really seen them interact at all. She just thinks of him as like her bastard brother. But I just love this idea that like, as she's in this point of desperation and wishing for a hero, it's like John is slowly becoming that hero a world away from her.
I love it.
And will eventually do like what she wants. Yeah.
Absolutely. I totally forgot about that. I'm so glad you brought it up. Now, John, of course, I think if John knows that he played any role in Ned's death, he might not have killed him, because I think that John would think, I don't want to do this out of vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do my duty.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, he's sort of like the true knight that Sansa reads about in her stories, right?
Right. He's just following through on...
This has to be done.
Yes.
This is justice. Mm-hmm. This guy has to die, right? So.
And the man who... God, I'm going to mess it up. Man who issues the sentence should swing the sword. Like,
yeah, right.
John's doing what Ned always taught him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh gosh, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's fantastic. Now, it's so interesting to me that Sansa is sort of surrounded by, I mean, King's Landing is just the worst place on earth, right? So it's going to be hard to find any true knights in King's Landing. But I think that she is learning that there is kind of no such thing as a true knight. And yet I almost feel like Jon Snow is the closest thing that we find to a true knight in this story. I mean, I guess Brienne too.
Yeah, right? I would say Brienne of Tarth supersedes yes. that maybe.
Right. But of course, we're not going to find her in Sansa's stories, right?
Well, again, the irony that like later in the books, I don't know if it's irony, whatever the best word is, but like that Brienne is eventually trying to find Sansa and protect her.
Right. Of course.
Which again, like the show got us to the point that they finally met. The books aren't there yet. And we don't know how that's going to shake out. But yeah, again, it's like I think it's not necessarily that there's no chance for a true knight. It's that none of the true knights are coming from the places where Sansa expects them. Like they're not in the Red Keep. They're not,
or that the yeah,
they're not serving the king
of King's Landing. Mm-hmm. Is just not a place where you can bring a true knight. Like what does Joffrey do? The first thing he does is he gets rid of Barristan Selmy.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like the system is constructed in a way so that if you are a true knight, you're kind of not welcome.
Hmm.
So there's no one really to save Sansa. Mm-hmm. And I think she kind of has to resolve to learn to be a survivor.
Mm-hmm.
Because if she doesn't do that, she could easily just be discarded. And once she's discarded, then her life is forfeit, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that that's like the moment that you see her tap into that is when Joffrey makes her face her father's head and she just like effectively dissociates. She's like,
oh,
I'm just, what does she say? She says,
he can make me look, but he can't make me see or see, but not look or something.
Yeah. He can make me look at the heads, but he can't make me see them. It's such a good way to phrase that of like, okay, I'm gonna have to like sit here and witness all of these things and like experience them, but I don't have to like in the moment let them sink into my head because I feel like she thinks that she won't survive like truly feeling all of her feelings in this moment.
And I think that she's learning that her interior life has to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be isolated. It has to be shielded. She has to create this political exterior for herself if she's going to
live.
Yes. All right. If she's going to survive Joffrey, she's going to have to sort of have this hardened political exterior.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. I found this passage. She says, "He can make me look at the heads," she told herself, "but he can't make me see them."
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
I think I want to return to the Hound just for a moment here, because I think that he is a guide in a way. It's similar to eventually he'll kind of become one of Arya's first teachers.
Yeah.
And in this way, and she's sort of right at the beginning of her life as an adult here. You know, even though she's a child, she's being forced to grow up. And I'm just going to read this little passage. It says, this is when she's back in her room before they go to court. Sir Meron and Sir Aris followed him out, but Sandor lingered long enough to yank her roughly to her feet. Save yourself some pain, girl, and give him what he wants. What does he want? Please tell me. He wants you to smile and smell sweet and be his lady love, the Hound rasped. He wants to hear you recite all of your pretty little words and the way that Septa taught you. He wants you to love him and fear him. So I kind of feel like he does not have to give her this advice.
Yeah.
And, you know, earlier on, he kind of, you know, she's noticing like he could be rougher. Like he could be, he's being a little, he says.
Almost, you know, gently.
Almost gently. So he is being rough, but she knows that he could be a bit rougher. And I think that this is all kind of him playing this part for Joffrey. And he knows I've got my part to play and she needs to learn hers. And I'm going to help her learn her part.
Yeah.
Which is totally messed up, right? he's totally a goon. But he kind of is a self-aware goon, and he's trying to help her be sort of a self-aware queen.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to her. Like, she's very perceptive of that in him, which I think is really important, too. That, like, I don't know how many times have people called her stupid, or I think Joffrey calls her stupid at some point, like,
He says even worse. He says that Cersei says she's stupid.
Right. Oh, God.
And she's like, what? Yeah. She said, what?
The queen was always so nice to me. Yeah. And she's not. She's just, she's been sheltered in a very specific way. And so the fact that she's able to tell, like, okay, he could have shoved me a little bit harder, or, like, you know, he pulled me up from the ground, but he's not hurting me. And she can tell that there's something different about the way that he's treating her as opposed to the other men in the room.
Well, and also at the end of this chapter, she sees him near the edge, and she's just thinking, I could just do it. Doesn't even matter if I go over with him. I could just push him and it'd be over, and I should do it. She's like telling herself, do it. And as she's kind of staring at him, the Hound leans, and it's sort of an italics between them to tend to her bloody face or something. It's one of these little moments where the Hound is subtly doing something to protect Joffrey, but I think he's also doing it to protect Sansa.
Yeah.
Because if Sansa lunges and she fails, then, you know, her life is now totally, it totally gets worse, right?
It's like she's dead either way. Either she pushes him, she pushes him over and goes with him, or she pushes him and is executed for
Or she tries to push him and then he tortures her. You know, even worse. So I think that he does, I think the Hound is doing these subtle little things to kind of make her life a little bit easier, while also sort of reinforcing this horrible patriarchy, right?
Yeah, it's almost like the Hound wants Sansa to live, right? He cares about her enough that he is ensuring her survival. And Sansa, I think in this chapter, like, we know she's thought about taking her own life. She at this point isn't sure that she wants to be alive. She kind of, I think, is in this headspace where maybe it would be better for this to all just be over. And so I think that we're kind of seeing that push and pull between he's trying to save her life and she's trying to figure out if she even wants to be saved at this point. And so that is to, for her to be in that space and to at least have one person, showing her that, hey, like, maybe you can survive this and here's how, is probably very significant to her in that moment.
And if you think about the Hound's backstory, you think he really does believe that this is how things are all over the world.
Yeah.
He doesn't like think, well, if I save her and bring her back to Winterfell, then her life's going to get easier. I really do think that he thinks this is what life is like.
Yeah.
Everywhere for every woman. And this woman, this girl has no one, and I'm going to have, she has to learn. She has to learn how to survive this world. I was thinking back, this is a very, very strange, obscure detail. This is sort of like Sansa's second chapter in this book. So this is sort of on the road to King's Landing. They've just left Winterfell. She kind of stumbles backward and she's about to fall and she feels a hand kind of support her and hold her up. And she immediately thinks, it's my father.
Mm.
And she realizes it's the Hound. And that's even more scary to her, right? Because he's got this horrible burnt face. But I do think that a lot of times in fiction, we need to pay attention to cases of mistaken identity.
Yeah.
Because I feel like the author is trying to tell something. I do think that in that moment, the Hound is playing a fatherly role, in a very messed up and weird and, you know, really, really odd way.
Yeah.
But I think that he knows Ned's dead. This girl has to grow up. I'm going to help her grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Politically speaking.
Yeah. I'm going to give her the mental tools to survive in this environment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, okay, so let's talk about Pycelle. This is sort of a a show difference.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember seeing, this is sort of the end, toward the end of the first season, you get this scene with Pycelle where he's, you know, he's sort of playing this decrepit old guy. And then he realized that he's got, like, you know, naked sex workers in his broom, and he kind of gets up and he like shakes off all of the kinks, and he you know stretches like he's a man 20 years younger, but before he leaves he kind of starts pretending to be decrepit again. And that's not in the books. There's nowhere in the books where that it gives us sort of that little window into Pycelle's character.
Yeah.
You kind of get the sense he's playing political games too, but he's always kind of playing the dotard. You never have him with sex workers, right?
Right.
So he's not really a man of sexual appetite. But I had completely forgotten about this little part in the book. And I think, in retrospect, this little detail is maybe what inspired that part of the show.
Mm. Yeah.
He's the kind of guy who will, like, pretend to be examining Sansa, but in reality, he's assaulting her.
Mm-hmm.
He's a total perv, but I don't think that this is... I think that the showrunners are making obvious what was sort of done kind of subtly in the book.
Yeah, I think that might be right. And like, it is, it's literally just one line. No real description of what happened. No real description of what Sansa was doing other than the fact that she was being held down, which tells us that like she was resistant to whatever was happening at some point, right?
Yes.
And I think that that's like just base level. Anyone who's in some sort of like a doctor position examining a child who's naked against their will is assault. And so it's like... The show did this thing where, and I want to say that, like, I want to say that there was a deleted scene later in the show where, like, Jamie or someone kind of, like, gives Pycelle a look of being like, I know that you're faking this. Or maybe it's Tywin. I feel like someone at some, in some deleted scene, they kind of acknowledge that again.
Interesting.
They decided to just sort of, like, never address it again because it was a sort of weird quirk that they introduced to his character,
right?
But yeah, the idea that he is being just as duplicitous and coming in to all of the, like, coming in and encountering all of these different people in the Red Keep with the intention of some sort of harm or some sort of, like, you know?
Well, we just said, like, the King's Landing is not a place where good people thrive, right? And so for him to, and he's as much of a creature of King's Landing as anyone, right?
Yeah.
You know, he's doing things that are politically advantageous for him. The fact that he's also this creepy guy is, it's just more to his character, I suppose.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't be surprised, but.
Right. It explains why he's been able to thrive in this environment, because he's kind of a rotten person inside. So, yeah, like, of course, he's happy to be a part of the court that is serving someone like King Joffrey.
Sure. Right. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, fun times. I also, I feel like anytime I talk about Sansa now, I always feel the need to, like, go a little bit into the way that I used to not like her character.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I read these books. I read these books for the first time when I was 20. And I was totally that little shithead who was like, oh, Arya rules, Sansa drools. Like,
I was the same shithead and I was older.
Isn't that so sad?
Uh-huh.
Like,
well, no, I think that we should be a little bit kinder to our previous selves. And here's why. I do think that we are intended by this book to love Arya.
Mm-hmm.
And Arya is always being described in counter-distinction to Sansa.
Yeah.
So the book is training us to love Arya and always, almost at every turn, showing us that Arya and Sansa are the opposites.
Right.
And of course, this is, you know, this book is told in first person, you know, limited perspective. And so everyone, in a sense, is a real unreliable narrator. And so we probably should have been a little bit wiser, you know. But I think that there is something that's being done, and it's a little bit of trickery on Martin's part to kind of side with Arya against Sansa. And it isn't until, I think, this later part of the book that we realize things are just as complicated, if not more complicated, for Sansa. Right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. That's my take on it. What do you think?
I think that you're right. And then I just kind of, like, zoom out even more. And I'm like, okay, why would George do that? Or, like, why is this a trope that we see in fantasy stories all the time of, like, badass little girl who, like, defies the patriarchy and is really brave and, like, makes her own way in the world versus girl who's a sucker for the fairy tale story and, like, gets bit in the ass because of it, basically. And, like, it just makes me kind of, as someone who was once a young girl watching all of the Disney princess movies and then grew up and somehow when I first met a character like Sansa in this book, my reflex was to be like, oh, that's like, she's being so lame. I really wish that she like didn't care so much about boys and her pretty dresses. Mm-hmm. Like I want the Arya character. And it's like, that's a narrative that was sold to me as a consumer of fiction, that like a girl wanting a happily ever after ending, mm-hmm. Is somehow not to be taken seriously, or is somehow not as important or significant, or she's weaker than the girl who knows from a young age that that's BS, and that she shouldn't dream about having a husband. She should dream about having a life. And like, mm-hmm. it just sucks that I truly believe that was just internalized misogyny on my behalf, that like at some point between being a kid who watched princess stories and then becoming a teenager, I absorbed this message that I shouldn't want to be like quote unquote basic, or like I shouldn't dream of being a housewife because that's bad. That's bad feminism. Good feminism is fighting the patriarchy. And so I'm just so much more sympathetic to Sansa now as an older woman who understands more about like the crappy way in which people are trained to think about young mm-hmm. girls who seem to be shallow, quote unquote, because of their interests and aren't treated with the same level of seriousness.
Yeah, I find this all very fascinating. And I, you know, I continue to kind of hold Arya as like a sort of a near and dear fictional character. Like, I feel like she's my favorite. Mm-hmm. I feel like Arya is not just like my favorite in this book. I feel like she's one of the most favorite characters I've ever met in any work of fiction.
Yeah.
And there is a part of me that wonders, is part of the reason that I like her is that she presents in more masculine ways than Sansa is.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, she's often mistaken for a boy. She's the kind of person that you want to root for as an underdog because of all the reasons that, you know, that you were just talking about. And so I do wonder at times, like, is part of my attraction to Arya because she presents in more traditionally masculine ways?
Yeah. And I mean, it's, I think that she's, I mean, I still love Arya deeply. I think that she's incredible. And I think that you're exactly right about what you said initially about that George also clearly loves Arya and wants mm-hmm. us to love her and wants us mm-hmm. to really be 100% behind every single thing that she's doing. Whereas because of the way that the chapters are written, we understand that Sansa has made a grievous error mm-hmm. at a very critical junction. And I think that leads a lot of people to think that she's to blame for Ned's death, or that like Ned, the way that everything went down at King's Landing wouldn't have happened if Sansa wasn't in the position that she was. And I just, yeah, it's like Arya is definitely presented as this like masculine, more gender ambiguous. I love that Maisie Williams only just recently said in an interview, like she thought Arya was queer until she got a script that said she had sex with Gendry. She was like, I always just assumed that was like, that she was sort of the example of someone who wasn't fitting into any gender binary.
Sure.
I don't remember really what I felt in real time for that scene other than like slight. It was just like, I love that episode, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. It's
one of the best episodes of the entire series.
Yeah, it's my favorite for season 8 for sure, probably up there in like top 3 for the whole series. And that was like one of the only moments that was, I could tell was supposed to land with me in some sort of emotional uh-huh. way that just didn't. I was like, I don't really know why that was just inserted there.
Mm-hmm.
And her being like, I'm not the red woman, take off your own pants. And I was like, okay, like, sure. I don't know. And then poor Gendry like tried to propose to her afterwards. And I was like, this is just a disaster.
Yeah. Poor Gendry.
Yeah. It was weird. But I like, I guess it's nice to have like enthusiastic consent for a sex scene in a show like Game of Thrones for a change. Maybe they just wanted us to have like one nice moment that wasn't incest. I don't know. Yeah, it was weird. But then, and then on the flip side, what they did with Sansa in season 8, I thought was incredible. Like seeing Sansa go from like wanting only nothing but to leave Winterfell and be in King's Landing and be a queen and have all these like courtly aspirations, to get her to the point where she is fully running Winterfell and like she is the best representation of Ned Stark that they have, of like really caring for all of her people, like, you know, welcoming Theon back with open arms and a hot bowl of soup and like really being like the Stark leader. I loved, and like, I loved Queen Sansa by the end. And
well, the, and that was, I was just recently reminded by one of my guests that that those are the last words of the series.
You know, the Queen of the North.
The Queen of the North. Mm-hmm. Is, it's the way it ends. Mm. It's the way that her story ends. And really, I think that in the same way we're kind of trained to root for Arya, we were kind of trained to root for the inhabitants of Winterfell.
Yeah. Right?
And so to see it kind of come full circle and, you know, under good governance is sort of, it's not the happy ending that we all would have liked, but it's kind of the happy ending that we got. Right?
So, and that's one thing that I'm very curious to know if George is trying to head there with Sansa or not. I don't know. I couldn't tell you if that's something that Benioff and Weiss just decided would be a great way to end her character on a note, or if that's like somehow part of the plan that they heard from George. But
yeah, I don't know, because it's so interesting because, you know, Sansa's narrative kind of gets conflated with Jane Poole's character.
Right.
Who's sort of the fake Arya up north.
Right.
So I don't, it's hard to know what's going to happen there. I had another guest, Stephanie Barbie Hammer. She was telling me that Sansa's always been her favorite character. Mm-hmm. And I kind of pressed her and said, so why? Tell me why. It's not my inclination at all. Like I've come to appreciate her, but it's just not my natural inclination. Mm-hmm. And what Steph said was Sansa's the only character in the show, or the only character in the books, that has no power but courtesy. Like she just has, all she's got are the lessons that Septa Mordane told her. And so she's the only one that's sort of playing by the rules of court. Mm-hmm. And so she's stripped. She doesn't have any dragons. She doesn't have any, you know, wolf magic. She doesn't have any of that. She doesn't have political allies. All she has are her manners. And she's going to survive with her man, and eventually she, you know, she is going to become a political player with power, right? But she's going to do it by playing by the rules of court. And so I thought that was an interesting way to look at her, and I think that the Hound kind of calls this back.
Yeah,
the little passage that I read earlier, he said, she says, what does she want from me, or what does Joffrey want from me? And he says, he wants you to pretend and recite all of the words that your Septa taught you. And if you do that, then you can at least survive another day, you know?
Yeah.
So I really do think that he's kind of taking over that role as her advisor or guide or something.
Yeah, I really love that point that you're saying your other guest brought up, because that is so true. And we see that. We see her figure out how to make that work, as opposed, it's like she takes that memorization of courtesies and courtly behavior, and instead of like despairing through that performance, she eventually figures out how to wield that performance.
Yes.
And becomes more politically savvy as she goes on.
Yes.
And that's totally true. Also, yeah, gosh, when you say like she doesn't even have wolf magic, for a second I was like, well, all the Stark kids, and I'm like, no, they killed like Lady.
They killed Lady.
Lady was the first to die for a reason. Like, it really just left Sansa
out there on an island.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's pretty badass that she figures out how to get her way back. She just does it in such a different way than her sister. And I also think it's notable that the Hound winds up serving a similar role for both of them in completely different capacities, right? Like, he helps, he is sort of like the guiding force for Sansa to be able to understand that she has to just play the part as a lady for a little while. Whereas with Arya, it's like he helps her understand more about like the brutalities and like the violence of the world.
He teaches her to be a better killer, basically.
Yeah,
it's interesting that, you know, those two are so different, and yet they do have some interesting parallels. I think that the thing that I most look forward to is that, and this is what I absolutely loved about season seven, but the thing that I most look forward to, if we can get these books published, I think I would really love to see Sansa and Arya kind of come back together, both meet up and figure out how to be sisters.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that, if I could get that resolution, I would be a pretty happy guy.
Yeah, same. As someone with two sisters, I'm like, really, George, give us some nice...
give us some bit of hope.
Some sisterly trauma recovery, please, would be great.
All right, so notable introductions to this chapter. I didn't find many notable introductions. You know, we're toward the end of the book, so I think we're done introducing things for the most part. But we do hear about Joffrey's name day for the first time, and that will be... It'll become an important setting for a later storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Notable departures. We knew that Ned had departed the narrative. We find out in this bit of the story that also Septa Mordain is a departure.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then show differences. I kind of mentioned the Pycelle stuff already. You know, he doesn't do this in the book. You know, this chapter has him inspecting her, whatever that entailed. That doesn't happen in the show, but of course they bring in his perviness in other ways.
Yeah.
So, did you notice any other differences between the show and this chapter?
Not a lot. Like, they obviously just sort of like mashed all of Joffrey's kingly orders and oversights, I think, just into the one example of the singer who gets to pick between his tongue and his fingers. And he makes him choose right then, I think, in the show, whereas he gives him one day in the book, but he cuts the hand off of someone else and imprisons.
Sure.
They basically just rolled like five horrible acts into one very straightforward, horrible act. But yeah, I remember thinking that Sophie Turner just acted the crap out of that scene up on the ramparts. I remember really loving.
Yeah, she was amazing.
The way she does that with Jack Gleeson in that moment. And yeah, Rory McCann is great as the Hound. Yeah, they really nailed, I think, that. They managed to kind of, I think, give us enough of an internal sight to what she was thinking in that moment without any dialogue.
Sure. In her interior in this book, we kind of see her look out over the city, kind of seeing for the first time how big the city is, and then imagining life beyond the walls to the north.
Yeah.
And then to the north and to the north of that, and then to Winterfell. And I think that this is a really important point for her character, because in previous chapters, the North represented sort of like the place where she was never going to truly become a queen.
Yeah.
And she just couldn't imagine. She, you know, Ned wanted to take her back home, and she was like, that's like my life is ending if you take me back home.
Mm.
And her whole life is wrapped up in the prospect of marrying the king and living in King's Landing. And now, for the first time, She just wants to see what's beyond the walls.
Yeah.
She's
been forced into like a 180 of now the prospect of actually having to marry Joffrey is tantamount to like her wanting to just die. And the fact that her father is dead and that she feels like she has no way of ever seeing Winterfell again. That was another, I wrote down this line too, when she finally takes a bath and she says the hot water made her think of Winterfell, and she took strength from that. So like she is now drawing emotional power from Winterfell in a way that she didn't before, because she didn't understand how meaningful that home was to her until she felt like she doesn't have it anymore. And this place where she thought would be her home and her salvation for the rest of her life is actually hell.
That's right. That's right. The one other thing I wanted to say about this chapter was there was this little moment when she realizes that Cersei has been lying to her, because he says, "You really are stupid, aren't you? Mother's worried that our children are going to be stupid too." And she's like shocked. You know, she says something like, "She did? She said that?" And it almost hurts more that Cersei thinks that than the fact that Joffrey would say it.
Yeah.
It's very much sort of like, I thought I had an ally in Cersei. I thought she was going to teach me how to be a queen. I thought she had my best interests in mind. Now I see that I have no one.
Yeah.
I am totally alone here.
Yeah. And that's like, that's the brutality of internalized misogyny, right? The way that women can be just as oppressive to other women. It is really hard when you realize that for the first time. I think again, like that's also part of why I feel so badly for the way that I used to think of Sansa. Cause I was like, God, like, what am I, team Cersei over here? Like, yeah, Sansa is so stupid. Like, God, it's so terrible, but that's a reality. And so I think that George does that well, of Sansa, like realizing like, oh, this queen that I thought was, like you said, my ally, my mentor in this place, also just thinks of me as a thing that Joffrey can breed. Yes. And if my kids are stupid, they'll both kill me. Like, God. Yeah. Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that the way that this book ends, you know, we have Arya spirited away by Yoren, almost to the point where like, okay, I think Arya's going to be okay. I think she's going to be fine. I'm not sure what's going to happen to Sansa. And you almost feel more fear for Sansa at this point than Arya.
Yeah. And I do think that it's notable that George, like, we see the execution from Arya's perspective, and obviously we see like her instant reaction to it, but then like that kind of gets interrupted with Yoren like coming at her and chopping off her hair, and you don't really understand quite like what's going on there. And then we go to Bran. So then like we see Bran get the news, but that chapter ends right after he gets the news. And then Sansa is like the first chapter where we're actually seeing an extended period of grief for one of the Stark kids, of like what it means that Ned is dead, like what that means to her, what that means for her mental health and like her ability to live at this point. And I think that is notable, that the first, like, we are absolutely supposed to be empathizing with her in this moment, because we, the reader, are also grieving for Ned. And this is like the longest time that we get to sit with a character who's grieving for him in the same way.
Yeah, that's true. That's totally true. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but we really don't see. I mean, we get a bit of that from Rob.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this is sort of, you're right, this is the most time we get to spend grieving for Ned.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, well, Kim, thank you so much. This has been a delight. And I would love to have you back whenever you're interested in coming back.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's nice to revisit.
Sure thing.
These books.
Now, for folks who would like to follow you, and, you know, follow your reporting of House of the Dragon, where can they find you online?
So I've recently abandoned Twitter. So sorry if anyone once found me there. So if you just go to insider.com, and search for like Kim Renfro, you'll find all my articles and stuff. And that's pretty much the
And you'll the be way. Covering House of the Dragon?
I will. Yeah. Pretty much in the same way that I covered Game of Thrones, I hope.
Okay.
We'll see what level of reader interest there is there, but I plan on doing the same types of like deep dives, hopefully some interviews, all the fun details, references you missed, and yeah, it should be. I'm so excited and also very curious just to kind of like see how this season goes. So
right.
I'm rolling with the punches as we head Absolutely. Into August.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcasts, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I want to revisit the topic of Brienne. In my conversation with Kim, we talked about the season 8 episode, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. And I thought I would include a short conversation between Steve and I about the Brienne scene. So here's an excerpt of my conversation with comic Steve Osborne.
A third of the way through the final season, and I'm feeling good. You know what I mean? Like, I feel good.
I will say, whenever I hear people disparage the final season and I'm feeling a little optimistic, I think back to the moment that Jaime says,
"You don't need a king. Any knight can make another knight." I'll prove it. Kneel, Lady Brienne. Do you want to be a knight or not? Neil.
She looks at Pod. Pod doesn't say anything. Pod just looks back at her like, do it. Like she and Pod have this sort of just visual shorthand now.
Yeah.
And you really believe this relationship between Jamie and Brienne is that kind of intimacy. And it's not romantic. It doesn't need to be romantic at this point. It's like, no, these two people really respect one another. And Jamie's finally clued in that she's every bit his equal, right?
Right.
I needed that. It's a wish that's so deep in her that she's afraid to even name it, right? She tries to play it off and say, I don't even really want to be a knight. Even though she's been saying her whole, you know, she's been saying throughout the last 7 seasons that don't call me lady. I'm not a lady. I'm not a lady.
Right, right.
But people don't really know what to call her.
Right.
And like, so deep down, she knows she wants to be called Sir Brienne. And here Jamie is kind of fulfilling this wish that's so deep in her she can't even name. I look back on that scene and I think, yeah, but season 8 had that scene.
Sure.
And I'm so glad that scene exists. And so the fact that season 8 has little scenes like that makes me think, let's not paint it with the same brush.
So I feel like, here's another thing, and this is now we're getting pretty meta probably, but like, I think season finales almost have to be treated as their own genre. Because
you can hear my full interview with Steve about this episode over at Double Dragon. Do a search for Double Dragon wherever you search for podcasts. And that is all for this week.